This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dragons and elephants, or as they say, honored people engaged in the Buddha way, and also welcome to everyone who's just curious about the Buddha way as well. So, as usual, we began our Sunday program with a period of meditation. We had meditation instruction, and we practiced sitting down and being quiet and still and coming back to ourselves, coming back to our body and mind. Really, just an ordinary affair. We do it all the time. We do it naturally. In this instance, we're doing it very deliberately, and we're doing it with a kind of seriousness to kind of meet ourselves, to become real in this particular way. The Buddha way is often described as the middle way. It goes against the current of normal activity. It is a way of moderation. It does not favor extremes of either indulgence or of discipline. In other words, the Buddha way is considered like a healthy effort to be authentic or real. So that's one aspect of the middle way. The other one is the middle way of Buddha is comprehensive. So it's an engagement of the whole person. In Buddhism, we have the threefold training, which is meditation, the meditation that we do ourselves, that we've done today. And it's also how we are in the world, how our conduct is in the world, like how we engage in relationships and how we relate to ourselves and to others and to the world. In Buddhism, we have these things called precepts. We actually take understandings about how we behave. So, and the other one is called prajna or wisdom, and it means just knowing. It means understanding. And strictly speaking, the word we use for meditation, the word Zen, comes from the word, the Chinese word Chan, and Chan is an abbreviation. That's the tradition, the meditation tradition in China, the Chan tradition. That's an abbreviation of the word Chana, which is actually a Chinese translation of the word Dhyana or Jhana. And Dhyana or Jhana simply means to know, to know. So the idea of meditation is, yes, we sit down, we meditate, we become still, but we come to knowledge. We come to know. And it's not a knowledge of information. It's experiential knowledge. So that's why they call it a practice. In other words, like, let's say a physician is practicing medicine. He practices medicine. He knows medicine, or she knows medicine. And that's the practice that she does. It's an experiential activity. Or a lawyer practices in law, whatever, you know, or whatever. And there's a third aspect which we're gonna try and unpack today. It's the aspect of the middle way. It's equanimous. It's equanimous. That means it's the Buddha way is balanced. It's non-biased. It exists in the realm of non-preferences, like we chanted today, like we chanted the Shin Shin Ming. Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful, wonderful teaching, Shin Shin Ming. We practice, and it comes from the meditation itself. We practice tolerance and harmony. We exist in a dualistic world. There's no escaping it. We exist in a dualistic world of likes and dislikes, of good, what we describe as good or bad. We exist in this dualistic world, but we exist in this dualistic world with tolerance and with harmony. That's the middle way. That's the middle way of the Buddha. There are always opposites in our life because we have views, because we have what's called discriminating consciousness. We like vanilla ice cream, but we don't like chocolate. We're discriminating against chocolate. How outrageous that someone would discriminate against chocolate, but they do. They prefer vanilla. And so we have discriminating consciousness. We make choices. And choices of liking vanilla or chocolate is not a big deal, of course. It's just a question of taste. But when discriminating consciousness comes into the realm of relationships, to the realm of how we relate to other people, how we relate to ourselves, discriminating consciousness can be a problem. And the middle way, the way of meditation, understands with discriminating consciousness that there is actually a non-contradiction of these opposites. Yes, there's chocolate. Yes, there's vanilla. And there can be chocolate and vanilla, or chocolate accommodating vanilla and vanilla accommodating chocolate. Actually, that sounds rather delicious. Have you ever had one of those whips when you get a vanilla ice cream, you get a little chocolate on top? Yeah. I think we've covered that very well. So these are the three aspects of the middle way. And we're gonna spend a little time on that third aspect, equanimity, or what it means to see things without bias, or to approach our life and approach the world, knowing that there's differences and there's discrimination within ourselves and within the world, but still have a kind of balance or equanimity with. So the metaphor that I like is a metaphor of the wind bell. And this is kind of a classic metaphor, and other teachers have mentioned this as well. So this is kind of a guide for us. So just like we should just be like the wind bell. You know, a wind bell, that's another term for a wind bell. A chime. You know, it's outside and it blows in the wind. And what does a wind bell do? It just responds. When the wind blows from the west, it responds to the wind blowing from the west. And it makes a sound. And when the wind blows from the east, it makes a sound and it blows from the east. When there's no wind, there's no sound. So that sense of just tolerance or accepting what comes to us, whether the wind is strong, you know, whether it's a tornado, say, you know, and the wind bell is just making a terrible racket. It doesn't care. It's just a wind bell. It just responds. Yeah. So that's kind of a metaphor for how to be equanimous. It said that the Buddha originally woke up in this state of equanimity. This is like a classical definition of that there were three jhanas, and the first jhana or state of knowledge was a state of knowledge of vikalpa jhana, which means, it's a Sanskrit word, it means the knowledge of discriminating consciousness. In other words, it's the realm of thought, of judgment, of making associations, and so on and so forth. The second jhana is the jhana of nirvikalpa jhana, which is the kind of knowing that kind of comes before thought. Sometimes we call this intuition. Intuition, or you can just get a feeling for something, you don't give it a name, or you don't describe it. That's nirvikalpa jhana. And the third jhana is the same nirvikalpa jhana, with a sense of relaxation and pleasure. And the fourth jhana is upeksha jhana, which is upeksha is another word for equanimity. It's a Sanskrit word for equanimity. It's the jhana of having non-discursive knowing. It's like before thought, before judgment, before associations. You just know, you are, and you know. And it's void of any preference for liking or disliking. It's totally, and everything is equal. Everything is the same. All dharmas, all phenomena are the same. So that's actually the state, it's said, and in the classical literature, that the Buddha woke up. This was like the receptive field where the Buddha could actually become enlightened. So, there's a story that is associated with Chan tradition in China. In the Tang Dynasty, there were many stories. They're called koans, or like public cases, stories that became famous. There's a story about, it's a well-known story, and Zen students, I think it's one of the most popular ones for some Zen students. In this story, two monks were, they were kind of like brother monks, and they were One was named Yunyan, and the other one was called Dao Ru. And Yunyan was sweeping. He was probably in the monastery yard or something, and he was sweeping away. So Yunyan was sweeping and sweeping. And Dao came up and said, "Too busy." In other words, like, here's someone that was working really hard, and his elder brother came up and said, "You're working too hard." And Yunyan said, "You should know that there's also one who is not busy." So I kind of imagine Yunyan is kind of a younger Zen student with a lot of energy, and he's really kind of into it. And his elder brother Dao Wu looks at him and says, he's trying too hard. He needs to kind of cool down a little bit." And he says, "You're sweeping too much. You're too busy." And Yunyan says, "Yeah, that may be so, but there's also one in me who's not busy." The story goes on a little bit further. Dao said, "Does that mean there's two moons?" By that, I think he meant, "Does that mean there's two selves, a self that's busy and not busy?" Dao said, "Is there two moons?" And Yunyan held up his room and said, "Which moon is this?" That's the end of the story. So, which moon is this? Recently, I was had a very frustrating experience. I'm an artist, and I was trying to get my airbrush going. And there's a bunch of fittings to my airbrush and the air compressor, and it wouldn't work, wouldn't work, it wouldn't work. And I was really, really frustrated and frustrated. And when we fixed it, finally, I had to say, "Oh, I give up," and had to go and get another part. And then it still isn't fixed, by the way. I still haven't got my English on. I was thinking, "Oh, this could apply to me. You know, can get his airbrush going, is really good with his tools, and has got the thing fixed. And there's also one who didn't fix it. And they're both me. They're both there." Now we could maybe apply this to our daily life. And you've met a friend, and your friend says a harsh word to you, and you love your friend, but your friend says a harsh word to you, and it upsets you. and you're really angry with your friend. But practicing equanimity, you remember that there's also one that loves your friend, that's not angry with your friend. Sometimes when we're afraid of something, I've noticed this. Sometimes when I'm afraid of something, I also notice that there's one who's not afraid. Have you noticed that? In the middle of being afraid, you notice that there's one within you who's not afraid. So this kind of broad view, this kind of overview is called upeksha or equanimity. Upeksha, the Sanskrit word for upeksha, is kind of a little bit bigger than equanimity. It actually means the first part of the word means to look to above. It means to be above. It means to above. And the sha means to look. It means to look over, look above. To the teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, once said, this is a kind of nice metaphor. He said, it's kind of like you're walking in a woods and there's all the trees and all the brush, and you need to know where you're going. You need to know your sense of place. You need to know the whole context of where you are. And you see a hill that's you see a hilltop that has just a few trees or no trees, and you walk up to that hilltop, and then you see the whole forest. You see the many trees. And you're able to have a context of where you are. You're not ignoring the individual trees. In other words, you're not ignoring the different aspects or details of your life, but you're rising above it and seeing all the details in context, and you're seeing the details as including their opposites. So right along with my frustration of not getting the tool fixed is the person who's actually, I'm really good with my tools, and I love tools. I just love tools, and I love to fix things. And there's that part of me that's actually pretty good. It didn't do very good that time, but most of the time it's pretty good. And both of those exist together. And there's within you the person that loves, completely loves, unequivocally loves everything, and yet is irritated with this person or that person or that aspect in yourself. So accepting both of those together, accepting the one who is busy and not busy together, is the practice of equanimity. And that is one of the fruition practices of this meditation. We think that we're just sitting down and following our breath and being quiet and being still and kind of taking a break from our ordinary business life. But perceptibly, the what's called the fruition of practice saturates into our life. It saturates into our life. Saturating into our life is a kind of insight or knowing of who we are and what we are and how we are in relationships. And saturating into our life is a kind of openness to other beings and to ourselves and to all things. And this is sometimes called karuna or compassion. It's the empathetic connection we have with all beings and with all things. That's the fruition of practice, it saturates in from practice. We don't, it's not something we have to ask to come into it. It naturally comes in, and it naturally from practice itself comes in the sense of equanimity, which is acceptance and tolerance of ourselves and of the world, and understanding that yes, in the midst of likes and dislikes, in the midst of chocolate and vanilla ice cream, in the midst of preferences, in the midst of strong views about this and strong views about that, there can be balance and equanimity and acceptance of ourselves and of all life. Well, I think that's enough. We can have time for some discussion. Does anyone have any thoughts about what we talked about, or have any questions? Yeah, Jackie.
At some point, you have to take action. And if you feel there's some injustice being done, but you're also feeling equanimous about what's going on, that feels very strange to me, because if I feel there's injustice, then I don't see how I can also feel animus about the injustice. Because I would want to take some action to remedy the situation.
What's described as it's a kind of unusual term, what's called a near enemy of equanimity is indifference. So sometimes when we think of equanimity, we think we don't care about this, or we don't care about that, or we don't have to act. And the near enemy is a little deceptive, because it's very close to equanimity, because equanimity is feeling like everything is all things are the same and they're equal, or that there's a balancing, a necessary balancing that must take place in whatever we do. And very close to that is a feeling of indifference, or just not caring. And that's called a near enemy of equanimity. And it's so close to equanimity as far as our receptivity of it, that we can be deceived into thinking indifference or not caring is the same as equanimity. Equanimity is actually taking care of, I mean, it's actually taking care of what needs to be taken care of. So always with equanimity, from equanimity becomes the appropriate response. So when it's time to act, the act will be appropriate. In other words, it won't be extreme. You won't be acting from against being angered. You won't be reacting and then overacting and inappropriately acting. You'll be appropriately acting. And when you act appropriately, it will bring things into balance, both yourself and what you're doing.
That's very helpful.
Any other thoughts or questions?
One quick question. In Buddhism, there is no not to.
There's no.
not meet.
Not to.
Which means
not to.
Yes. You don't distinguish between yourself and not yourself.
Right.
It's external and internal self. And when we were explaining
when you're
that story, when you were explaining that story that you just told us, you told us that the person who is busy is also a person that is not busy.
Not busy?
Yes. Can you explain how that explanation like is aligned with the not to theory?
Not to?
Yes.
Actually, it's that not to is actually what
it is. I think it's also like equivalent no distinguishing, like you don't distinguish something that is like, for example, yourself or not yourself.
Right.
So I read that from this.
Right. From the Xin Qin Ming?
Yes, exactly.
This this not to usually we the way the normal way that we negotiate the world is we have the circumstance that we're our consciousness, you know, our sense of being or a sense of awareness is biologically located in a body, you know. So I have this body, and from this body there's a consciousness, you know. And the normal, I would say, and the normal way is to assume that is separate from everything that is not it, you know, everything that's not me, you know, all of you are not me, you know, is the normal way of thinking. Sorry, none of you are me. That's the normal way of thinking. When you think about it logically, and I think I talked about this a week, maybe last week or a week before, that you can actually make the argument that everything that is not you is defining you, because without everything that is not you, without all of you, and without all this whole external world that is apparently not me, there would be no me. There would be no me. So the argument could be made that all of you and everything that is not me is defining me, and so you, in a certain sense, I need all of you and I need the whole world to be me. So this me is totally dependent on everything that is not me. Do you understand?
Yeah. Understand, there's a situation, like everything's linked together.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is influencing each other. So in our worries.
That's right. Yeah. So to carry that argument a little bit farther is that because everything that is not me defines me, there's actually no distinction between everything between me and what is not me. So there is no self in the midst of self. There is not two. There is not two. So just to come back to your original question, okay? And to answer your other question, yes, the original teachings of the Buddha, in fact, the teachings that the Buddha, when he first had his enlightenment experience, it was actually a thought of inclusion. He didn't say, I was awakened independently. It's really wonderful. He said, this is how the story goes. He said, this is wonderful. I've awakened with all beings. I've awakened as all beings. I've awakened as all existence. So he, in a certain sense, you could say he lost his self, but like self, the sense of self and non-self totally disappeared. There's not one, not two. It's a good question. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to add on that a little bit. So I think in the Heart Sutra, there is something about like no suffering and no not suffering, and like the entirety of Heart Sutra is basically no this, no that, and basically just negates everything. It looks like it's nihilism from the outsidings, but I think what's going on is it's trying to negate the concepts. So if you say self and then no self, but like I think it's trying to say that there is no, the concept itself is faulty. You know, so it's like you can say, oh, I have self, and I have, and I don't have, but the problem is that you have an I. So yeah. by negating I don't have, there's no I don't have, there's no I have, then it's really trying to say that there is no I. So the no I is really like the middle way. I mean, there are multiple interpretations, one of which is yeah, what's her name? Sorry.
Mike.
Mike, yeah, Mike was saying basically one way of interpreting it is there, like the way we make concepts is by fixating, right? Like I kind of like lock it down, but like that is itself is not right. Which you cited about like the impermanence nature of I. So therefore, like you can't lock things down that way. I is like an ever-making kind of like, you know, fluid kind of concept. So it's not a concept in a traditional sense. So there is no I in the traditional sense, but like there is a, you can say I, you know, in daily life, but not, it's not wrong, but it's kind of wrong deeply. Because when you say I, you're fixating. So that's why there's like no I have, no I don't have, no suffering, no I don't suffer. Like, and then there unlock some Buddhasava acts. Yeah. And like basically I think what's going on is that then you still have to fixate something. My interpretation is then you fixate on other people, and that's the best way. You know, so like you can negate yourself, negate not yourself, and then you fixate on others.
Yeah.
You know, you're not like fixating on I anymore. So that's a good way out of it, I think.
Another way of talking about this is to see this selfing that we do as kind of the same thing that you said, as a kind of fabrication or construction. And we can't discount it. I mean, we spent our whole life constructing this identity of own being, of Swadharma, and it's got memory number, you know, it's got a credit card debt, whatever, you know, it's got stuff applied to it, and it's got families and issues, and it's not a small thing, this amazing construction we have. But if we really want to come into reality, come into and see things as they are, and to become authentic in this way, we need to understand as you mentioned, that it is a fabrication. It's a conventional fabrication, and also it's not independent. It's impermanent. You are going to die. I'm sorry, but you're on this small little zone between birth and death, and that's it. And it's impermanent, and it's totally interconnected and involved with everything else. It's dependent on everything else. And you are completely involved with everyone else, with the trees, with everything else. So you can applaud your independence, your free will, and whatever, but remember that there's one also dependent and involved and engaged and in context. There's one also not sweeping, you know, that's totally not sweeping. How's our time?
What time is it? 11:30.
What?
11:30.
Is it time?
Yeah.
Okay. Any questions from the peanut gallery? Good. I would, before we close, just for fun, I would encourage us, myself as well, to kind of do a take-home assignment. So your take-home assignment is kind of practice this sense of equanimity. I realize it might be a stretch, but practice a sense of equanimity. So when you notice you're afraid of something, acknowledge that you're afraid. I'm afraid of something. But in the midst of acknowledging that you're afraid of something, also acknowledging there's also one with that one who's afraid, who's not afraid. When you hate something or something, or you have a strong dislike of something, acknowledge that. Acknowledge that. So I acknowledge that I don't like that. And as you acknowledge it, also acknowledge to yourself, along with that, there's also one within me who's accepting this, who even likes this painful thing that's happening to me. So little things in your life, little incidents in your life, I challenge you all to kind of apply them to these little, to practice them in little ways to see if you can practice equanimity in very small ways and kind of balance. And it will, besides pacifying you, it may keep you from being reactive to things or overreacting to things. And it may help you to see that kind of overview, that big view that sees both and at the same time. Okay. So that's your assignment for the week. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So at the bottom of page two, after.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.